From Nebraska to California, Pennsylvania to Texas, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, as America says goodbye to Charlie Kirk, Cliff Maloney from the Citizens Alliance is here with a remembrance. Many states offer subsidies to the film industry to attract their productions, but the cost to taxpayers often outweighs the economic benefits. Eric Boehm and Joe Lancaster of Reason Magazine explain. And there have been many inappropriate comments on both the legacy and social media in the wake of the Charlie Kirk assassination. How should we respond? Colin Hanna from Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Funeral services for slain conservative activist Charlie Kirk are being held this weekend. Cliff Maloney is CEO of the Citizens Alliance. He worked closely with Charlie during last year's presidential election and joins us now for a remembrance. Cliff, welcome to American Radio Journal. Cliff, looking back at the past week or so since the tragedy that befell Charlie Kirk, the outpouring that has occurred across this country, in fact, across the world, is something we really haven't seen, really, I think, since the assassination of Martin Luther King or even Bobby Kennedy. A lot of folks may not have heard of Charlie Kirk, but he clearly had an impact on younger generations. What was it about what Charlie was doing and how he did it that has resulted in this sort of a visceral reaction from people all over?
If they hadn't heard of Charlie before, they most certainly have now. And I think that's the one, I hate to even use the word silver lining, but the one takeaway from this horrific tragedy of this lunatic deciding that violence is the path to take somebody out that you disagree with politically. I think what got people excited about Charlie, you know, he was a dear friend of mine, was his authenticity. You know, the left tried to destroy him for a decade. And he just was always a happy warrior. He would do these campus events with the ideas being, listen, we need to talk. When you stop talking as a country, that is when bad things happen. We have to find common ground. And if we agree to disagree, we do it mutually, but we understand where the other person is coming from. I mean, Charlie just had such a knack for bringing people together. When a lot of people on the left try to say, oh, he would destroy college kids and this and that, it's like he was capturing moments of real discussion. And on the left, I mean, Loman, who of all the listeners out there, who can name one person on the left that is out there encouraging people on the right to have an open dialogue and debate in a public forum? I can't think of one prominent Democrat that is doing that the way that Charlie did. And for them to decide that, you know, the only way to end his so-called hate that they've been brainwashed to believe is to put a bullet to take his life, it's just such a tragedy. But now those people that were not familiar with Charlie, I'm not talking about political folks. I'm talking about people that are trying to put get their kids to soccer practice, put food on the table, pay their mortgage. They're now turning and looking into Charlie and saying, man, is all that crazy stuff that I heard about him true? And when they listen to his words and they see his actual actions, they realize, man, some of these people on the left are just bonkers. They're crazy. And I think it's just giving him a much larger platform, and his message is reaching the masses after this tragedy.
Isn't that one of the great ironies in this whole situation, Cliff, where we always hear from all sides, well, we need to have a responsible dialogue. We need to talk to each other. Well, here you had a guy who was doing just that, talking to, as you pointed out, both sides. The left suppresses free speech from the right, and yet, even though he was doing what it is we all say we want to do, look at what happened.
Yeah, and that is the irony. I think that's the right word, you know, is that the rhetoric of the left, you know, I mean, I miss the old, I really miss the old school Democrats, you know, the Kennedy-type Democrats who, you know, would have rational thoughts. They were, you know, America first when it came to war. they were very progressive when it came to free speech. Even the health. I mean, look at Bobby Kennedy, you know, with Make America Healthy Again. I mean, there was a lot of things that the old school Democrats represented. Now, there's plenty of Democrats like that around the country. They're becoming more and more switching to Republicans, but they don't have that in leadership. You know, who is the Democrat leader right now? What solutions are they offering? What is their talking point to galvanize the American people other than Trump and all of his followers are fascists? They're Hitler. They are misogynists. They're homophobic. I mean, that's their message. And if your message is this person is Hitler, well, what's the proper response? Bad things, right? We all consider Hitler to be evil. And so that's the type of rhetoric that, you know, they're going to keep saying, oh, well, we have to tone it down. Well, I'm looking at you. I'm looking at every Democrat leader. You need to tone it down. You need to tone down this idea that everybody that disagrees with you is evil, because crazy people hear that and they take action. And that's what we saw, unfortunately, in Utah.
You mentioned that Charlie Kirk was a personal friend of yours, Cliff. And last year in the Trump presidential campaign, the president has rightly credited Charlie, along with yourself, a number of others, in helping to win swing states. He, of course, ran the table on all the swing states. Tell us a bit about how you worked with Charlie on that effort.
Back when I ran Young Americans for Liberty, 2016 through 2020, you know, Charlie and I really crossed paths quite a bit, and I'd go to all these events, and I'd always see, you know, activists from my organization, but then there were all these turning point activists. I mean, Charlie understood the hard work that it takes to recruit people. You know, political activism is not easy. It is not a glorious job. A lot of people are volunteering their time, even if they're paid activists. You know, it's a tough gig, but Turning Point would show up. And, you know, at Citizens Alliance, we've always been focused on state legislative policy and races. State House, State Senate, and certain states, State Assembly, because, you know, we think that knocking doors at that level is where you can have the greatest impact. Well, all that changed in 2024. You know, Charlie called me and said, look, he says, I'm focused on Arizona. I'm focused on Wisconsin. But we need somebody and we need an organization that will take on the actual chasing or harvesting of ballots in Pennsylvania. Now, in Pennsylvania, you can't harvest, so obviously it's a chase. But that's what Charlie was able to organize. He was able to get certain organizations that would go out and raise the money, vet and hire the people that would chase the ballots, and then actually run the logistics and run the programs. And so he asked us to knock 500,000 doors in PA. He asked us, you know, he'd say you probably need about 120 people, 10 Airbnbs. I had to go out and raise $3 million, which was not easy. But it was an honor of a lifetime to have Charlie to recruit me to go into Pennsylvania, one of the largest swing states, and then obviously to see our success, knocking 510,000 doors, taking Trump's share of the mail-in from roughly the 20% average that Republicans were getting to 34.5% against Kamala, delivering PA alongside so many patriots that made it possible, and flipping the White House. And Loman, I'll tell you, my favorite memory was from inside the CAP office, the Citizens Alliance of PA headquarters, right there in Camp Hill, Lemoyne, PA, on election night on Charlie Kirk's live stream. It's a video that many of your listeners have seen where Charlie is sitting in his seat. We call it, because Fox News calls it from PA, we're talking, Erica walks in as Charlie is breaking down in tears, hugs him, and I say, remember this moment, remember this moment. You told me to go back to PA. I believed in you. You believed in me. And that is something that I will never forget. And that video obviously went viral. And the weirdest thing for me was I was just on with Jack Posobiec earlier this week, and he said, Cliff, the thing you have to remember is that not only did Charlie say it's all God from his seat, but that is the exact place where Erica came out on Friday night and gave what I think will be a speech that will go down in the history book saying, we are just getting started. And that, to me, is powerful.
Tell us a little bit, Cliff, more about the Citizens Alliance. Tell us a bit about your organization. Where can folks go to find out more?
Pennsylvania is our bread and butter. It is our number one focus for everybody out there nationally that is looking for something to get involved with. We are not just doing this every 4 years. We are not just doing this every other year for the midterms. The Democrats are on the ground 365 days a year. So we are matching them. The PHAs has relaunched. We've been on the ground since August 4th in Pennsylvania across the entire Commonwealth. We have pledged to knock 500,000 doors this year. We pledged next year to knock 750,000 for the midterms and governor's race. And even fast forward to 2028, you know, we are publicly stating we are going to knock $1 million doors to the PHA's program. So my ask to all the listeners out there, you know, I'm doing this because Charlie would want us to continue to do the work. There was the three words that he would always say to me, to every activist out there, do the work. And so PHA's is committed to that. Folks want to support us. It's $175 to sponsor an entire day of chasing ballots in PA. PHA's.com. I would encourage everybody to get involved. If we are able to make Pennsylvania the next Ohio or the next Florida, meaning it is a red state, it is the red wall that makes it practically impossible for Democrats to win a national election again. That is what we're all in on at Citizens Alliance. And I think with hard work, with grit, with some determination, I think we've got the secret sauce to make it happen. And I think it's exactly what Charlie would want us to do.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, keeping an eye not only on what is happening in Washington, D.C., but also across the pond. Scott, good to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be back, Loman. Thank you.
President Trump has been on a state visit to the United Kingdom. Some very glittering events with King Charles and also some business. What's going on over there?
This week, President Trump was accompanied by First Lady and a lot of his senior staff for a pretty important visit over to Britain to meet with King Charles at Windsor Castle. And then he also met with the Prime Minister Starmer. And it was a real opportunity for them to discuss what's going on between the economic relationship with the UK and the United States of America. President Trump is a man that wants to get these big deals, right? And in this instance, he's looking to have a big economic tie and potentially easing tariffs and then having a big tech prosperity deal that will focus a lot on artificial intelligence and tech. And, you know, those are emerging sectors, not just for the United States, but I think also in Europe. And we have a very strong relationship historically with the United Kingdom. Obviously, there's a fascination in American politics when it still comes to the UK. But this was a good visit for President Trump, a big one for him, and again, striking another deal with a big economic partner.
President Trump, of course, on his second state visit there, Scott, which is apparently unprecedented, of course, serving two non-consecutive terms, which we haven't seen since Grover Cleveland. So we are indeed in unique times. Let's switch now to the U.S. economy. You did talk about trade with the United Kingdom. In terms of the U.S. economy, President Trump, Scott, has been pressuring the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates. Have they actually finally done that?
Yeah, I think it's important because when you think about the rate hikes from March of 2022, when Bidenflation was still soaring all the way through July of 2023, there were 10 instances when the Fed increased rates by 25 to 75 basis points, which is a tremendous impact trying to limit the out-of-control inflation that was going on at the time, but really making us feel the pinch here domestically. And so leading into the 2024 election, we saw sort of a politicization of the Fed where they cut rates in September by 50 basis points, and then they cut it by another 25 basis points right on the election, and 25 more basis points as Biden left office. But they were really hesitant to decrease rates at all underneath President Trump. He's had significant meetings with the Fed and Jerome Powell to try to encourage them that, you know, now's the time to cut interest rates and try to, you know, continue this economic boom in the United States of America and boost employment.
The 25 basis point cut, though, Scott, I've been reading some analysis where this is still not enough to get the housing industry out of the doldrums it's been in, because you have you have a lot of people who are in that mid-range who aren't moving up because they don't want higher rates. They currently have mortgages at lower rates, and also the people just trying to get in can't afford the rate. So is it really going to be necessary for the Fed to do those additional cuts to get the housing market, get it back on track?
I would love to see that. You know, I think right now the average mortgage interest rate is roughly 6.7 to 7%, something like that is the average in the United States. A lot of people have what are called the golden handcuffs, where you are locked in on a 30-year fixed rate at, you know, 2.7% or 2.9% because you purchased a home when the economy was really healthy prior to COVID.
We, of course, will continue to keep track of all that. We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, we always like to hear a few words about the club and where folks can find you online.
The website is clubforgrowth.org, and you might say, why should I go to that website? Well, you can go there, sign up and become a member for free, where you can ingest all the club's information as it relates to the candidates that we're supporting and the policies that we're advocating for within the Trump administration and on Capitol Hill. You can also follow us on X at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson, as always, Scott, thank you for taking time to be with us.
You're welcome.
Marvel has been filming its movies in Georgia due to tax incentives. But are those incentives paying off in more economic activity? Eric Boehm and Joe Lancaster of Reason Magazine have the answer.
If you've seen a superhero movie, a Marvel movie, or even a non-Marvel superhero movie anytime in, say, I don't know, the past decade and a half, and don't lie, you have. You've seen at least one. You went to see Avengers at some point. Then you've seen a movie that was probably filmed in substantial part not in Hollywood, but actually outside of Atlanta. In Georgia. That's where Marvel's been set up for many, many years. But that is now changing. And that is the result of not some sort of epic clash between heroes and villains, but rather due to government policy, maybe misguided government policy, that lured those Marvel movies there in the first place. That's what we're going to take a look at today, folks. Hi, I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is my colleague, Joe Lancaster. He writes for us at Reason.com, and he's got a terrific piece that you can find there. Film subsidies weren't enough to keep Marvel in Georgia. Maybe that gives it away a little bit, Joe, but that's it's the great headline. Really sums things up. Thanks for joining us here on the program.
Thanks for having me. You know, you got to front load something interesting, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. We got to hook them. Got to get them in here. You know, got to have that fight scene in the first act to get the audience together. That's how you write a superhero story. Look, Marvel has been there. You know, maybe people aren't actually aware of this. People who don't pay attention to movies and the whole, you know, nerd culture as much as I do. But Marvel's filmed, you know, just about everything at that big studio they built outside of Atlanta for decades now. But that's starting to change.
Yeah, it's Atlanta has kind of been, or Georgia has been kind of really pushing itself as an attractive location for film production for 50 years at this point. But for a long time, that took the form of really lobbying on the state's behalf or kind of going to bat on behalf of a production with the state government to help smooth over red tape. In the early 2000s, that's when you start to see legislative proposals where not only would states kind of roll out the red carpet for these big film and TV productions, but they would actually apportion money for the studios themselves, either in the form of tax credits or in some cases even just outright infusions of cash.
Yeah, as you point out in the piece here, there was a state law passed in 2008 that provided a tax credit of 20% for a studio's expenses in the state. And then that went up all the way actually to 30% later on if they met certain characteristics. So, I mean, Georgia's been throwing these tax credits at movies for a long time. You also note in here, however, that, you know, okay, the big blockbuster Superman movie from this summer was largely filmed just outside of Atlanta. But the follow-up movie to that, Supergirl, is being filmed over in the United Kingdom. On the other hand, the taxpayers might be better off if all these movies end up moving their production out of Georgia or over to the United Kingdom or wherever, because you went through and looked at a bunch of audits that suggest, you know, all this money Georgia's been throwing at these productions for years really kind of hasn't been worth it.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, if you ask the industry, they'll say, well, this is necessary. We have to have this. These, you know, these subsidies, these tax incentives, all that kind of stuff. But just about every year for the last 3, 4, 5 years, there's been some sort of either state-funded or state-affiliated audit that found, you know, the economic activity that comes from these investments doesn't really pay off. It's not worth it in the end for the amount of money that the state either gives away or just foregoes in tax revenue. There's a report came out in 2023, it was commissioned by Georgia State University, and it found that you know, that these credits are always sold as, you know, well, yes, we're paying however many millions or billions of dollars, but what we get out of it, we create all these jobs, we all this kind of stuff. The audit in 2023 found that each job created by these credits cost Georgia taxpayers just over $160,000. And they found a return on investment of 0.19 or 19 cents per dollar for every dollar that was spent on this program. So it is just a terrible investment from just from a purely dollars and cents perspective, a terrible investment for the state.
Yeah, and a terrible investment, as we said, in an industry that kind of by its very nature can pick up and move and go wherever. Joe, I wonder, just about a minute or so left here, but I wonder if there's some broader lesson here that goes beyond just, TV subsidies and film subsidies. But, there's a lot of talk right now, especially at the federal level, about industrial policy. And, there's probably some lessons to be drawn out of this in that area, too.
Absolutely. I mean, this is kind of a big picture, a flashy version of this sort of thing, but it's the same sort of thing that happens all the time in states and, like you mentioned, in federal halls of power on occasion where, our lawmakers make decisions where, well, we need to prop up this particular company or this industry. You know, we need to get manufacturing back in the U.S. And so, well, they can make things so cheap overseas. So obviously what we need to do is just pump a bunch of money into this particular industry or this particular region and just, spend a bunch of taxpayer money propping up these industries, making it easier for them to do business. And ultimately, in the end, it's the same as with Marvel. The companies are going to go wherever it's cheapest. They certainly like getting free money. Who among us doesn't? But that doesn't buy any sort of long-term loyalty, and it doesn't mean that they're going to look the other way if somebody else still makes them a better offer.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, it's the you can see some short-term returns on the spending a lot of times. You know, as I think it was Ronald Reagan who famously said, "If you subsidize something, you get more of it." Right, and that's going to be true. You're going to get more of it, but whether it sticks around long-term or not, that's really the question. They're there because the subsidies are there. Somebody offers a bigger deal, better deal, they will go somewhere else, and that seems to be what's happening. Check out Joe's piece at Reason.com. Film subsidies weren't enough to keep Marvel in Georgia. Some big lessons there, I think, about industrial policy in general. Joe, thanks for taking some time with us today, man.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And once again, that is Joe Lancaster. He's an assistant editor at Reason. Find his work and my work and all of our work at Reason.com. And of course, for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
We can take a lesson from the Amish community as to how to handle those who make wildly inappropriate comments, such as we have seen in the wake of the Charlie Kirk assassination. So says Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this American Radio Journal commentary.
It's no exaggeration to say that we're in a moment of national confusion over how to react properly to the horror of Charlie Kirk's assassination. Somehow, this particular shooting has prompted more widespread, if not deeper, angst than any other shooting in recent times. There's a yearning throughout most of the nation for some solution, but the solutions offered are uniformly misconceived and will be ineffective. First, let's look at some headlines in reaction to Kirk's death. Left-wing radicalism is staring us in the face. Don't let Kirk's killing become Trump's Reichstag fire. Stop left-wing terror networks and their funding. MAGA vows to silence foes. Trump invokes Kirk's killing in justifying measures to silence opponents on the left. Report those who celebrate Charlie Kirk's death to employers. It doesn't stop until the power of the state is used to deconstruct left-wing terror networks. Political figures and political media across the entire spectrum are decrying political violence, but when addressing what to do about it, they typically blame the other side and suggest that some kind of government power, executive, legislative, or judicial, should be exercised to bring an end to it. unworkable and sophomoric distinctions between free speech and hate speech are offered as helpful in deciding what's permissible speech and what's impermissible, as if there were some kind of discernible line between the two that is intuitively obvious. There is no such line, which basically means that there is no such distinction. Why is any form of speech protected by the First Amendment? There's no need for protection of innocuous speech. It's only offensive speech that needs protection. Even trying to single out speech inciting violence is an arbitrary and ultimately futile task, although there have been some court rulings that try to do it. So let me suggest an entirely different approach. Social leadership. Our society can make certain kinds of speech anathema, which is to say utterly unacceptable by the vast majority. It's an ever-changing and evolving standard, to be sure, but its imprecision doesn't render it ineffective. Here are a few examples. When I was growing up 60 or so years ago, it was considered impolite but not uncommon to hear and use slang that demeaned races, ethnicities, and sexual orientation. There was even an immigration law enforcement initiative in the 1950s created by the head of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service, called Operation Wetback. Now such words are considered so offensive that they are effectively banned by society without any law, executive action, or court decision mandating it. I'm from Pennsylvania, where we have a substantial Amish population, and the Amish culture offers us an example of how society can ban something without ever needing to define it legally. The practice is called shunning. It's the Amish equivalent of excommunication, but societal as well as ecclesiastical. While it bears some similarity to the modern phenomenon known as cancel culture, it is more thoughtful and socially significant. Civic dialogue should be public conversation and exchange of ideas on societal issues to foster understanding, collaboration, and collective problem solving. It should open communication among diverse groups to address common concerns and find inclusive solutions. The goal of civic dialogue is therefore to build trust, strengthen community bonds, and promote a more engaged and democratic society. That should be our national goal in honor of Charlie Kirk. The way to tone down the rhetoric in American political debate and discussion is to focus on civility as a necessary element of civic dialogue. It requires honest, strong, nonpartisan, and non-ideological leadership. It cannot be accomplished by one person or one party or one social group. There must be a multiplicity of leaders who figuratively speak the same language. The recent appearance of my two Pennsylvania senators on the Common Ground segment of Fox News Channel's special report is a good example. But of course, it needs to be duplicated by hundreds, if not thousands, of other leaders, both within and outside of politics. It would be best if it could be initiated by the highest office in the land. Nothing else will turn this inflection point into genuine renewal of American society. But it can happen, and every listener to American Radio Journal can help make it happen. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WYAY-FM in Wilmington, North Carolina, WPGI-FM in Charleston, South Carolina, along with WBSS-AM in Linwood, New Jersey. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.